When he returned to the hallway, the water had risen over the prostrate Baron's mouth and nose. The magnificent Kreka wasn't blowing any bubbles. Doc splashed down the corridor and up the stairs. As he climbed out of the entry well, he glimpsed the destruction he'd wrought. A deep, dark torrent had gouged away the villain square and was undermining the blockhouse. He could see no one moving. Had he drowned the very people he'd been trying to save? He drew his Civil War-era hand blaster from its holster, the Lamah, and ran along the face of the building, away from the rushing water. Doc found the Steyr long blaster where he'd hidden it. As he shrugged into its shoulder strap, he saw shadowy figures hurrying toward him from the base of the mountain. He primed the Lamah's shotgun barrel.
Do not come any closer!
Doc, it's us!
John Barrymore! And Ryan! Is everyone else all right? Did they all make it away safely?
We got lucky. Just scrapes and bruises. Come on, see for yourself. They're waiting for us.
I trust our carnival friends were not so fortunate.
They all started moving toward the hillside.
We saw a few of them go down in the flood. The rest are somewhere on the other side of all that water.
The Baron is probably under it by now. He is no longer a matter of concern.
The old man unslung the Steyr and handed it over to its rightful owner.
Ah, glad you picked that up. I feel naked without it.
Do not try to fire it before you check the bore. The muzzle is probably blocked with dried mud.
As they neared the foot of the slope, figures rushed out of the shadows to greet them. Doc received a hearty slap on the back from Mildred and a kiss on the cheek from Christy. Jack nodded to him, which from the albino was an absolutely eloquent acknowledgement of Doc's courage and heroism. When the congratulations were over, they got right down to business.
Are we still in danger? Should we try to move out of here tonight?
The pool seems to have stopped its activity, at least for the time being. No more storm clouds, no more spores. But there's no guarantee that it won't start up again before it's run completely dry.
How long before the lake is empty?
It could take all night. There's no way of telling how deep it is.
We can't leave here. Not in the dark. Not knowing the terrain. Not knowing where the Rousties went. We've got to hunker down and ride it out until sunrise.
JB's right. We'll take turns standing watch. Dean, Lilu, Doc, and Christy can sack out first. We'll wake you in 3 hours. We move out at dawn.
Doc stood with Ryan and watched young Dean escort the little girl to a safe, relatively comfortable place among the boulders. After they'd sat down, the boy removed his coat and draped it over her shoulders. She curled up with her head against his chest and his protective arm over her.
The reports of chivalry's demise appear to be greatly exaggerated.
He's a good boy with a good heart, and he's going to grow into an even better man.
There you go bragging again, lover.
What can I say?
At first light, Ryan led the companions to what was left of the Ville Square. The roaring river had become a feeble creek. The shantytown was gone. The blockhouse was full with standing water. They jumped down into the muddy channel the torrent had left behind and moved in fighting formation with weapons drawn to the other side. When they climbed out of the riverbed, they found nothing to shoot at. There were no signs of life. They'd been hoping that the Baja bug had survived the flood. The little wag, even overloaded with bodies, would have made it much easier for them to get back to the interstate. But it had vanished. The companions had no choice but to walk out, to return Lilu to Bullard. They took the route past the burning pool. When they reached the bank, where the evil had first touched them, they stopped and stared for a long time at what was revealed. The bottom of the lake was gray, a solid mass of lustreless gray that followed the contours of the bedrock beneath. There were small standing puddles on its surface. It didn't move. Nothing moved on its surface.
But it's just goo. In Dublin's fair
city, where girls then, a high-pitched sound filtered down from the forest above. Because it was intermittent, Ryan didn't recognize it as singing at first. But it was. A familiar bell-like soprano drifted through the dense trees along the ridgeline, and it grew stronger and more distinct. The companions strained to hear, barely breathing, until it faded to silence. Crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive. Keep listening for a special extended preview after these announcements. Stranded in the salty desert wastes of West Texas, Ryan and his companions find pre-dark wheels and set out on a treacherous journey across inhospitable terrain. Hopes for a hot meal and clean bed in an isolated vill die fast when the companions run into a despotic baron manipulating the lifeblood of the desert, water. But it's his fortress, stockpiled with enough armaments to wage war in the dunes, that interests Ryan, especially when he learns the enemy may be none other than a legend of the Deathlands, and the most influential figure in Ryan Cotter's life. Deathlands 63, Devil Riders. Deathlands Damnation Roadshow is a Cutting Audio production. Copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation. Performed by Richard Rowan, with Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Timberlee Chanel, Thomas Penny, Christopher Walker, and Kate Torrey. Directed by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Vocal editing by Matt Webb. Sound design by Brian Patton and Dan Smith. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Brian Patton, Dan Smith, and Matt Webb. All song vocals were performed by Nanette Savard. If you enjoy Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders. Available at roadstops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.cuttingaudio.com.